Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with sharp insight and expert analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, ID check chaos, why Home Affairs says a 6,500% fee hike is essential for national security. Half of young South Africans want out. Is this the final warning on the brain drain? What the Johannesburg Deeds Office shutdown means for home sales and agents. Blue cranes are now officially vulnerable. What it says about our disappearing wild. It's Thursday, the 26th of June. Now, from the 1st of July, the cost of verifying a South African ID is going to skyrocket from 15 cents to 10 rand for real-time checks. The Department of Home Affairs, as I understand it, says it's about security and ending abuse of the system. But there's been strong pushback. Banks, fintechs and digital service providers warn it could exclude vulnerable users and stifle innovation. Capitec says it's going to absorb the cost for now. TymeBank calls it, and I quote, a crippling blow. Kasatu says more protection is needed. So let's put all of that on the table. I'm joined by the Minister of Home Affairs, Dr. Leon Schreiber. Let's talk about the rationale and what it means for you and I, the financial system and the digital economy. Minister, welcome. Thank you very much indeed. Maybe let's start with this. Where's the evidence that the 15 cent checks posed a security risk? What have you discerned?
Hi, Jeremy. Good to be with you again. So this all started with us trying to answer a pretty fundamental question, which is why do we have the challenge of system offline at Home Affairs offices? And we investigated that challenge and we found really two main culprits. The first one being services that run through CETA, the State Information Technology Agency. But the second one is about the National Population Register itself. Now, this is the database that sits at the foundation of our state. And it is this database that is used when you access Home Affairs services, but also various other services, SASSA, the justice system, etc. So we had to then ask the question, why is the NPR failing more than 50% of the time? And this is a critical point. In other words, more than half of real-time verifications do not succeed currently. And that is a risk to national security when you have a system that is performing that poorly. We tried to answer that question and we found that since the real-time verification service was introduced in 2013 at a price that was absurdly low, 15 cents, that's less than the price of a chappie, is where we priced your South African identity. And that robbed us and the department of the resources for maintenance and upgrades over a number of years. And this is despite the fact that similar services in the private sector often cost 20 rand for a single verification, not 15 cents. So effectively what was going on here is that taxpayers were subsidizing this service because it does not cost Home Affairs 15 cents to provide. And that was driving profits in the private sector. We also then found, because this price was so low, that there was widespread abuse taking place. I can give you one example where, because it's only 15 cents per verification, we had users who were uploading their entire database to the live queue every single day just to check if one person had died on their database. And so that is a clear example of the abuse that then leads to the overloading of the system. And that is why you have system offline challenges across the board. So that's basically the background as to why this needs to be very urgently addressed.
Minister, why have you rejected a volume-based or phased model, as has been proposed by some fintechs, instead of hitting it with one sweep?
Well, of course, the irony is that there are claims about not having proper public consultation, which is just an outright lie. We have had a 30-day period that was gazetted for public consultation. We engaged in written consultations. We had a number of in-person meetings, including with associations. And it was precisely because of these consultations that we did introduce a new solution. This is the offline queue, which only costs 1 rand per verification, not 10 rand. And essentially, Jeremy, what we need to do here is urgently, in the interest of national security, get people to stop overloading the live queue. And this is the irony of the approach that has been taken by someone like Time, where, well, firstly, I think the CEO does not even live in South Africa, so I think he's unaware of the scale of the crisis at SASSA and Home Affairs. But secondly, many of our users are now working with us so that we can achieve our shared goal, which is to optimize usage. Because the price is now set at the correct level, these users have an incentive to move as many of their transactions to the off-peak queue that I've just mentioned. This will run when Home Affairs offices are not open, SASSA and SAPS are not using the system so intensely, overnight, and then we can check things like death records. So that is what almost every single other user is doing. There's just this one outlier that is making all kinds of untrue claims about lacking consultation, and they're pretending as if the offline queue wasn't introduced. This is exactly the solution to the problem.
What about the assertion that the new system will exclude vulnerable users?
Well, that is just absolutely untrue, because the current system excludes vulnerable users. Again, I say more than 50% of real-time verifications currently fail. That's what exclusion looks like. A broken system where you can't get service at Home Affairs, where you can't get yourself verified at SASSA, where you can't open a bank account because we can't verify your identity, and where fraud takes place because people then bypass the system that's broken. That is the cost. That is the exclusion. That is what we're trying to fix by just simply ending a taxpayer subsidy that has gone straight into the pockets of these big corporate entities. The vast majority, every single one of them, in fact, outside of this one user, have recognized that argument, because they've engaged with us during the public consultation process. But we have it on record that the CEO of Time Bank didn't even read the personal letter we sent to him inviting public consultation. He woke up after that window had closed, and now he's desperately trying to protect his pockets while we're trying to fix a system for all South Africans.
So you've got a beef with Time Bank at the moment. What efforts are going to be made to resolve that?
Well, it's very simple. Every other user has contacted us on the email address we've created for them to set up their usage ahead of the go live date, which is the 1st of July. What they should have done and what they can still do is get in touch with us on that email address so that we can optimize their usage. We're sitting as we speak with our users, looking at agreements we have now put in place with them to say, how many of the volumes that you're currently loading into the live queue can we move into the off-peak queue so that you save money and our system doesn't fall over? Very important point to make as well, Jeremy. We've already built an upgrade. So we've tested it with three of our users, including government's justice cluster. And the statistics from yesterday show that 271,000 verifications were done in the live queue by the justice cluster, with an average response time now of 2 milliseconds and not one error. We've already built that upgrade at taxpayer expense. So they're going to get a better service. They're going to have the option of paying a lower price for non-real-time verifications. Every single other user is working with us to optimize that system. That is what everyone should be doing.
And you're prepared to commit to a review in time and either adjust or reverse if access does suffer?
Well, I just simply don't believe that that is possible, that access is going to suffer. Because as I've said to you, access is already collapsing. The system doesn't work in more than 50% of cases. Access is going to improve because we're finally going to have a system that's upgraded. We've already built that. And we're going to manage traffic better. But like every other service that is not an entitlement or a right, we have to make it sustainable. The difference with Home Affairs is, if the National Population Register goes down, the foundation of public sector services, as well as the foundation of private sector profits, collapses. That is what we need to avoid.
I'm going to leave it there. Dr. Leon Schreiber, Minister of Home Affairs, thank you very much for joining me today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, a new brand map survey is sending us a chilling message. Nearly half of South Africans under the age of 35 say they are likely to emigrate in the next 5 years. It's not just a brain drain, it's a soul train or soul drain, and it could reshape the country's economic and social future. This cohort is young, educated and mobile, and they're looking elsewhere for safety, opportunity and stability. So why is the country failing to hold on to its future leaders, and can anything still be done to make them stay? I want to talk now to Brandon de Kock. He's been on the program with us before. He's director of storytelling at BrandMap, the team behind the research that I would imagine is rattling policymakers and business leaders alike. So this is an astonishing number, Brandon. A very warm welcome to you. Do you think this is just an emotional reaction to the ongoing news cycle, or have we reached something of a tipping point here?
Hi there, Jeremy. Yeah, it is. I think it's a very sobering statistic. You know, the interesting thing is it's not necessarily if it is a tipping point, it's one we've seen coming for years. This is not a particularly new finding. It's a little exacerbated, I guess, on the last couple of years. There's so many pieces to this puzzle. I think the first one is just sheer economics, right? I mean, I think the current minimum wage in South Africa is something like 28 rand an hour, right? The minimum wage in America is $7.50. So, you know, that's 140 bucks an hour. That's if you're working in a deli. Imagine what the income differential is if you are a highly qualified young university graduate in South Africa. So, you know, there's your first starting point. There's a sheer reality about, I've been to university. I've got a really, really good degree. I've got a business science degree. I'm an engineer. I'm a something. And I can literally earn, you know, 5, 6, 7 times more and live that lifestyle in another place. So I think that's the very first sobering thing. You know, we can't ignore the weakness of our economy.
But it's more than that, though, than economics. It's also about safety concern. It's about perhaps the potential of a better lifestyle in other countries. But you also, I think, in the research, talk about a sense of hopelessness.
Yeah, well, I think we've always been the half full people at BrandMap. We try to sort of, you know, pep things up a little and go, things are not as bad. But I guess if you're a young person and you're looking at the last 10 years, it feels like our moments of hope get dashed pretty quickly. You know, it's almost like whenever good things happen, with the exception perhaps of winning World Cup rugby tournaments, I mean, it feels like it. You know, there's always something slightly worse around the corner. And I think that instability, that general instability, if you're young and you're educated and you're tapped into a global world, you know, our young people are global citizens, as we all are. They know what reality looks like in Europe or in Australia. And our reality is very different. It must be very hard to be super hopeful about a future in a country like ours where we just don't know what's going to happen next. You know, we don't know whether the electricity is going to go off. We don't know what's going to happen politically. There's very little stable to hold on to, not even the weather if you live in Cape Town. You
know? What we don't know, of course, is whether these intentions would turn into real departure.
That's exactly the point. So if there is a bright piece of the story, you know, if we're talking about 45% of people under the age of 35 saying that they are likely or very likely to think about emigrating in the next 5 years. That would be, you know, 3 million people leaving the country. The chances of them, A, doing it, I mean, it's not that easy to leave. If you buy your way out, you know, it's an 8 to 10 million rand problem you're faced with. What you would need to do is you'd need to be employed overseas. You know, you'd need to emigrate with a job of some sort. I'm not sure that's going to happen to 3 million qualified South African youth. But it's the fact that it's in their heads that worries me. You know, that we are, whatever we're doing here, it is not providing enough comfort and enough hope for young people to not show the willingness. So you know what I mean? So that's what I think the worrying thing is given half a chance, 45% of people look like they would leave. What's even more worrying is that another 25% of the youth tick the unsure box. Yeah, and all they would need is a half good reason. So we're talking about the vast majority of people are basically saying, if I was given half a chance to go and live elsewhere right now, I would seriously consider it.
Are there segments of this young cohort that are most at risk of leaving? Have you looked at either profession, education level, or income?
So education level is quite interesting. You know, when you talk about ethnicity, funnily, has absolutely nothing to do with it. You know, I think we've got past the stage. I think our youthful cohorts in South Africa are very homogenous in terms of their thinking along these lines. When it comes to the most highly educated, interestingly, because of government employ, particularly with very high levels of education, so your sort of postgraduates, the postgraduates are almost some of the happiest, maybe because they're also earning very, very high levels anyway. The challenge for me is more in the area of artisans, of people with technical degrees. I mean, you know what a massive issue we have with engineers in South Africa right now. You know, we're thousands and thousands of engineers down, and we're not replacing them. And those are the people who look like the most likely to want to leave. You know, it's the people with skills that are vital to the economy and literally to the running of the country. So that's where we see the soft spot.
So let me try and find a little silver lining here. From the data that you've analyzed, are there any pushback factors that emerge? In other words, reasons why some people within that group are still committed to staying?
So I wouldn't say that we don't necessarily have pointers in the data, other than the fact that the irony is that levels of optimism about South Africa's future have risen sharply since the last election, even with younger people. I mean, we saw the majority of people being pessimistic, and now the majority are more optimistic, even of younger people. So, and I think therein lies the key about where we started the conversation, that it's not necessarily that I'm completely hopeless about the future of South Africa. It's more selfish or more self-centered. Mm. It's about looking at where we are now, what would offer me the best opportunity. So I think it's and that's kind of the sadness in a way. It's almost like we have so many reasons to feel positive, and that we should be able to lay a really, really good groundwork for young people to feel like there's a future for them here. But somehow, and I really think it's the economic realities more than anything. Mm-hmm. So if we change that, you know, given where the world is right now, there's some places I would far rather not be than South Africa. Mm. You know, given the dangers that are out there.
Yeah, I mean, I fully concur with that, but nonetheless, it is a very sobering report. I'm going to leave it there. Brandon de Kock, thank you very much indeed. Director of Storytelling at BrandMap. Always appreciate the insight.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, a major headache for Johannesburg's property market, and one that I am sure you are aware of. The Johannesburg Deeds Office has shut its doors indefinitely, throwing thousands of property transactions into limbo. What it means is that sellers can't access the proceeds of their sales, and estate agents are being left for months without commission, all while bills obviously keep piling up. I want to discuss this in a little more detail now with Jason Joffa, who's business head at Lamna Bridging Finance, which is stepping in to offer short-term relief. So as the backlog builds, what options do sellers and agents really have to stay afloat? So Jason, a very warm welcome. Maybe let's go back to the basics if we can. How did this deeds office closure come about? And why, in your opinion, has it caused such severe disruption?
Okay, on the surface, it's, you know, it manifests across the country. It's just rearing its head in Johannesburg, and it's about a matter of time that it happens in the other 11 deeds offices, Joburg being the biggest one. And if anybody were to go and have a look at the statistics and rule out the decline in the property market, they would still see that we're about 20% of where we were last year at this time in terms of transfers. What should normally take 6 to 12 weeks is now taking months longer, and we have stats across the various regions. The sellers can't access their money, estate agents aren't getting paid, and everyone's cash flow is under absolute pressure. People that want to sell their homes are not able to realize the proceeds. They're not able then to purchase new properties, and then those OTPs lapse. Estate agents, same thing over there. Often estate agents just work on commission. They have to put up money up front for marketing costs. So you can just imagine how it's affecting their working capital cycle.
And Jason, the reality of the situation is we don't know how much longer this is going to perpetuate.
Correct. So there's been a lot of promises that they're going to be moving to new premises. I mean, if anybody's been to the Marble Towers building in Joburg, it's just absolutely not fit for human habitat. And I can understand why they've gone on a go slow. You know, these are skilled people that work over there. The conveyancing process is very complex. You can't expect them to go into a building where the lifts are not working, where the air conditioning's not working, etc. They were supposed to move into a new building 3 weeks ago, and that still has not materialized.
All right, let's talk about bridging finance then. Can you explain to me how it works in simple terms for both sellers and agents?
Okay, so from a sales point of view, if you've sold your property and it's about to be lodged in the deeds office in a real-world scenario, we are able to obviously give up to 80% of the proceeds. So you'd realize the money up front instead of having to wait out the entire process. Same thing with agents. We're able to give up to 70% of the commission. With the rates and taxes, we're able to pay the rates out of the proceeds. So it enables the property to actually sell.
And how are you making your margin?
So our margin is based on the discounting transaction. It is a high-risk transaction. We don't take any security. So it is an expensive product, but it's an opportunity cost.
So how quickly can someone access funds once the sale is delayed or stuck in the deeds office backlog?
So if all conditions are met, we like to, you know, we want to say within 24 hours, depending on your attorney's cooperation or your conveyancer's cooperation, they'll sign an undertaking. And once the funds have been transferred into their trust account, they will then pay us the capital amount plus the discounting rate.
And what sort of take up have you had so far?
So we've been around for 11 years, you know, so we've built a big business at the moment. Yeah, we've got national presence from Cape Town to Mosina and from Pongola to Port Nolloth.
But the take up in the short term, given that the situation is becoming worse, are more and more people turning to this option?
So, yeah, the last 6 months we've really seen an uptake. We're probably up 40% year on year.
What type of screening process does a person have to undergo before they can access the loan?
So as we're saying here, it's a discounting transaction. It's not a typical credit transaction where we have to look at serviceability. All of the serviceability is actually coming out of the future sale of the property. So you know, if you've got small judgments or anything, we tend to overlook those kinds of things.
And the demographic of people taking up the bridging finance option, particularly when it comes to sellers, do you have an idea of who is using the service perhaps more than others?
Yes, it actually goes across the board. You know, what we like to call in our business is asset rich, cash flow poor. So it's people that have large properties, unencumbered properties, and everything is tied up in the property. So we're able to assist those clients, as well as the smaller guys who've just, you know, not been able to pay their rates and taxes because they want to put bread on the table.
Point taken, but are there risks or downsides to using bridging finance that sellers or agents should be aware of?
Yes, there are risks. You know, nothing goes without risks, and we price for those risks. Ultimately, it's an opportunity cost. Money now is worth more than money at a later point in time, and that's how we position the product.
It's not just the sellers and the agents, Jason, but I understand this is also applicable to property developers, or at least property developers are experiencing an issue here, given that they've had to pause projects. What are you hearing from them, and are you also stepping into the breach there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it doesn't take much to notice. If you drive around Johannesburg, you see half-completed properties because guys have simply run out of capital. What we're able to over there, what we're able to do is advance on plot and plan where certain properties in the developer's portfolio have been sold. So they're able to put working capital into their new properties, get to the next milestone, and then the banks can come in at that point in time.
Not to take anything away from the business solution that you're offering, it's also a sad indictment of the city of Johannesburg, isn't it? Given that property development and sale has reached this juncture.
Yes, you've hit the nail on the head over there. We probably wouldn't exist as a business if it was 100% efficient. I'm not saying, you know, we wanted to be, you know, we obviously wanted to have more efficiencies. But yeah, that's pretty much what I can say around that over there. I don't think anywhere in the world it's 100% efficient. There's always going to be complexities in a property transaction. Conveyancing process isn't a straight green line. You know, you've got to understand conveyancing.
Explain to me how you work with conveyancers and attorneys in the process. One assumes or one hopes it's a seamless partnership.
Yeah, absolutely. So we call them our channel partners. You know, we're there to enable a transaction to take place, particularly when it's things like outstanding rates, taxes, and levies. They're not able to progress to the point of lodging in the deeds office until those affairs are sorted. So we're able to step in at that point. Clients come and go, but customers to us are important. And our agents and our attorneys are customers.
And Jason, just looking forward very quickly, the deeds office backlog has been an issue in the past, and there's no doubt it's going to continue for some time. Do you think there's a longer term role for bridging finance in the South African property market beyond this particular crisis?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, we do a hell of a lot of other products in our world over here. It's nothing different to invoice discounting at its purest form. Cash in the pocket now based on a transaction that's going to happen in the future.
I'm going to leave it there. Jason Joffa, thank you very much indeed. Business head at Lamna Bridging Finance. I appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, you might have heard that South Africa's national bird, the blue crane, is now officially vulnerable. Habitat loss, power lines and pesticides all pushing them towards extinction. And I read that something in the region of 25,000 are left. So obviously this is a wake-up call. Big question, of course, is can we save this important wildlife heritage? I'm in conversation now with Dr. Christy Craig from the Endangered Wildlife Trust. Dr. Craig, a very warm welcome to you. How many years then until blue cranes are extinct unless something is done?
It's quite a difficult question, I think. So with blue cranes, they're quite a long-lived species. And with the red listing, we work on generation length, which means that their generation length for three generations is about 36 years. So we're looking at quite long time periods. We've done some projected models. So in our models, there is a 0% chance of extinction in the next 100 years, but there is a good chance, and we're seeing a decline. So we're not necessarily seeing an extinction, but we're seeing a massive drop in the population, which is definitely concerning.
At the start of the conversation, I mentioned habitat loss, power lines, and pesticides. Of those, what are you most concerned about? Is it agriculture or energy infrastructure that is more responsible?
We would say energy infrastructure is the main threat. Agriculture, it depends where you are in the country. So they use quite different habitats. In the grasslands, they're using natural habitats, and in the Karoo. Whereas in the Western Cape, you find them primarily in these very transformed wheatlands. So certainly in the grasslands, habitat transformation from agriculture has been an issue. But in the Western Cape, it's less clear. So we're trying to figure out exactly how they're interacting with the agricultural landscape and sort of figure out what is causing the problem, if there is anything habitat-wise that is causing the problem, or if it's to do with poisoning and disturbance and other more direct threats.
So let me pick you up on the poisoning issue, if I can, because that is worrying. To what extent is that happening, and does that obviously fall squarely on the shoulders of big agribusiness?
So poisoning is something that was a lot more common in sort of the 80s, a little bit into the 90s. It then very much sort of disappeared in the last couple of years, but in the last, say, 2 years, we've had two or three blue crane poisonings in the Western Cape. So we are concerned that it's starting to pick up again. I think most farmers are very aware of the legal issues around using poison. So I think we're possibly seeing the tip of the iceberg. Mm. It's a difficult thing to get good information on, but certainly I am concerned that we are starting to see more poisonings in the last couple of years.
And Dr. Craig, broadly then, what type of intervention is needed to start reversing the process?
So I think we have good experience with conserving blue cranes. We've been doing conservation work in South Africa for the last almost 50 years, or more than 50 years actually. So we have a good idea of what needs to be done. A lot of our work is centered around landowner engagement and working with farmers to, I would say most farmers in the Western Cape are very pro-blue grains. They want to have blue grains on their farm. So it's just about working with farmers to figure out, okay, what do these blue grains need? What do you guys need to do to make a safer environment for them? And then obviously on the power line issue, we need to make sure that new power lines are routed in a responsible way. We need to make sure that we are marking power lines that are already up. We found from research that marking power lines for blue cranes is more than 90% effective. We know that it works, so we just need to continue that work. And then around the poisoning issue, we obviously need to raise more awareness, have more of a presence in the landscape so that when farmers are having issues with crop damage from geese and rodents and other animals, that they've got the support that they need so they don't end up having to resort to things like poisoning.
Do you think there is an appetite among the multiple stakeholders that you've just listed to try and actually do something? Because it's always going to be difficult, isn't it, to balance that relationship between progress on the one hand and nature on the other?
Yeah, certainly. I think there is certainly an appetite from the agricultural sector, I would say. In terms of energy development, we do have a partnership with Eskom around working on these issues. So yeah, I'm fairly optimistic that we can move forward with the work and have an impact.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Dr. Christy Craig from the Endangered Wildlife Trust. I appreciate your time today. Thank you. And that's where we're going to leave it for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.